Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in at home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in at home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Now, very happy to introduce our guest this evening. We have, as ever, Keith Wood. And Keith has been opening the contacts book and bringing different former players, former teammates onto the show to chat. We had Sean Fitzpatrick recently. We had George Gregan. I must confess, when he told me his next or our next guest was a former teammate of his, I thought, really, I'm not too sure. Over 200 appearances for Harlequins, English international, British and Irish line, the South African tour of 2009. We are, of course, talking about Ugo Monya. Now, I'm not sure what the age difference is, Ugo. I am surprised to hear that you were ever in the same room. Hello.
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm just slightly concerned to all your listeners and viewers that you've gone from Sean Fitzpatrick to George Gregan to me. So Keith definitely is going through his phone book in alphabetical order, and he's finally reached the bottom of the barrel. He's reached you. But no, thanks for having me on.
Keith, teammates, you too.
We were teammates. It is a long time ago. When you were starting your little intro there, I thought you were going to say 200 years ago. But it was, I was at the end of my career. I had a couple of really bad injuries at the very end. I hurt my neck. And then in trying to come back from the neck injury, my shoulder went again. And then all the old scar tissue from the different operations happened. So I was broken. I was a broken man at the end of 2002, start of 2003. And I went training with Paul Pook, who I think some of the rugby nerds out there will know was the fitness coach for Ireland when they won the Grand Slam in 2009. Cracking guy, great Welsh guy, really good, good guy, put a huge amount of time and effort into me. And Ugo arrived, I think he arrived at the summer 2002. I'm thinking I have that in my head. And had picked up a bit of an injury because he was a proper athlete. We were all pretending to be athletes, but he was a proper athlete. And he was 17 or 18 years of age. And we ended up training together, actually, for about 6 months, which it gives him an insight into me and me an insight into him. But he was the kid, but I learned an awful lot from him, actually.
See, it's funny Keith says that because from my perspective, I was this kid at school trying to make my way in professional rugby. And I remember saying to my mum that I wasn't going to go to university. I was going to take a year out and just see how this rugby thing went. She was fairly sceptical. No, you've got to educate, do your education further. That will give you the foundations for whatever you want to do. Anyway, I went against my mum's word, turned up at Quinn's, and within a couple of months, I got injured. And I found myself partnering with Keith Wood. But that was weird in itself, because the previous summer, I was watching the live tour 2001, where Keith Wood was the world's best player. He was named Player of the Year in world rugby. and then he becomes your training buddy. So that was just, that was weird. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was speaking to friends of mine who were at school, hey, what's this person like? What's this person like? And I'm like, my training partner's Keith Wood, you know, the world's best rugby player. So it was cool, but then you put a winger with a hooker and they just shouldn't get on. But I was in awe of Keith, and the biggest compliment I could ever give Keith is that back in 2001, 2002, we did have mentoring programs. As a professional, you did your thing and you cracked on. And I know that's a responsibility some of senior players do now. We didn't have that for Keith. He didn't have to put an arm around me. He didn't have to pass on the knowledge, the wealth of knowledge he had, but he did that. And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of players at Harlequins that didn't, but I'm forever indebted to Keith because I learned a huge amount in terms of what it takes to be a professional, what it is to train properly, and what commitment really looks like. And so in terms of my first few months, it didn't happen the way I wanted it to. I didn't want to be injured, but it was the best thing that could have happened to me.
So when we say a mentoring program, you mean he bullied you, he made you clean up after him, do what you're told.
I would say he was a dictator or anything. He led by example in the gym, but I think anyone who's grown up in a sporting environment will know that a banter slash abuse is the term of endearment. And so as much as I got the odd cuddle, I did get a slap around the face occasionally, and it was, I don't know, maybe I'm kidding myself, but I look back on those times and just think it's all out of love.
Absolutely. I tell you, it's a crazy sort of time, very hard time in sport when you get injured. Mm. And look, I did injuries my whole career. I think we've discussed this before. I missed maybe half my career, a load of caps, all that sort of stuff through injury. And you get used to it. But when you're 17 or 18 years of age, and this is the dream that you set yourself out, and as you said, you argued with your mother whether you should play rugby or go to college, and a couple of months into it, you're injured. You learn an awful lot about yourself very, very quickly. And when I say I learned an awful lot from Hugo, and we don't want this to be a full love-in session, but but it was that idea that and at that age, at that stage of my career, so I was 30, 31 at that stage. I knew I was on, you know, the final furlong. So I was so hungry for any bit of information, anything that could make me a little bit better. And so I wasn't able to do a lot of weights at the very start. And I kept having the surgery and, three different surgeries in that 6 month period of time. But the idea that you could go and run on the track with, an athlete, because, you know, we were rugby players. And so you're suddenly learning on your last 6 months of your career, you're actually learning how to power properly, how to transfer all the training that you'd actually done onto the track. And I didn't do a huge amount on the track because track is a really unforgiving surface for guys of my weight. You know, it's a really tough place to be. But to suddenly go in there and to, you know, you think you're fast, and I was pretty fast, and then you're not fast at all, actually, because all I could see. So I'd like to say I trained with Hugo, but I trained behind Hugo for an awful lot of that year. But it was interesting because it's lonely, actually. When you're injured, it's a lonely place to be.
Mm. Hugo, I think I'm right in saying, I've certainly read it of you, that at the age of 16, you ran the 100 metres in 10.6 seconds. So you were unbelievably fast. Growing up as a teenager, I know the conversation with your mum and pursuing rugby over education. Were you rugby player first, sprinter second, or vice versa? Or what was your relationship with the game?
It was tough. I was actually a footballer first. I was born in North London, so all I wanted to do was just play for Arsenal. Then I went to a posh school and they told me they didn't play chaff ball. I said, what's that? And they said, football. So they wanted to play a proper sport called rugby. I'll tell you what, when you're the only black kid, actually I wasn't the only black kid, my brother was also at the school with me. So when you're one of two black kids at the school, you just do what you can just to try and fit in. And so I just cracked on, got involved, but I love my athletics. But then the one thing I realised, you get to 16, 17, and you start to have to make decisions. What do you want to channel all of your ability into? You can't spread them out because you end up just being average at both. So it was rugby, and Harlequins offered me a contract. And I remember I played a few games when I finally got back fit, and they offered me a contract. I now think I'm a Del Boy out of Only Fools and Horses. So what kind of money are we talking? He said, £8,000. I went, make it 8.5. And he said, yep. And I was like, sweet, absolutely done him there. I thought I was getting the best deal in the world, but it was actually just the satisfaction of knowing that I was able to earn my first ever professional contract. Didn't matter what it was. So as much as athletics was huge for me and the background, I guess lots of it was transferable, especially when you end up playing on the wing.
And how was the school experience?
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. I mean, that's the birthplace for my love for rugby, and I'm still involved in it now. So if not for that school, I wouldn't have been on the pathway to playing rugby. So it was great taking a boy out of the city, sticking him in the country. I didn't know anything else. First time I'd probably been away from my mum and the family. So yeah, there were challenges, but I look back at how my personality was shaped and how I was able to develop resilience and be adaptable, just learn new skills, make new friends. Some of them we're still good friends with today. My experience at school was absolutely incredible. I loved it.
And why were you plucked from city to posh school out in the country?
I think my mum just realised that I had some level of sporting talent and I was never going to achieve the things I was going to do in the city. Far too many distractions. My dad wasn't around as a youngster, so I probably didn't have that fatherly figure to be able to just direct me in the right way, as well as try to keep me out of trouble, because it's really easy to get into trouble as a kid. It's really easy to get into trouble as an adult. So I probably needed a bit more attention. I just needed to focus myself. And fair play to my mum for identifying it, because I think when you're a single mother and you've got five kids, it's easy just to allow things just to happen and try and sweep up the mess after. But she was really proactive and wanted to put me in a school where I could be all I could be. So I went from a classroom size of 35 to 6. But how can you not learn? And I'm still thick as you like anyway. So that just goes to show you, how far I've potentially come along. So it was all down to my mum. And the way of thanking my mum was actually then arguing with her about further my education. But I've got to say, this is probably the only time where I've gone against a mum's word and end up making the right decision.
Okay, so Mother Manya is the hero of this story. That's the short version.
Yeah, that's the short version, absolutely.
Yeah, wow, amazing. And so when you're training with Keith Wood and you've got your contract, your 8,500, very important. how quickly do you establish yourself in the team then when you get back from injury, and is it all smooth sailing? It rarely is.
No, and this is the one part of professional sport where I guess going back to the start of our career and coming to the end of Woody's, we're straddling amateur era, slowly going into professional. I look at millennials today that have only ever known professional sport. The one thing I understood was you really had to earn it. I don't care how good you were at school and what you achieved at England or Ireland underage group. When you come into professional environment, you're starting again. I walked into the change room. I wouldn't even dare put my bag on a bench. I trained next to the bench, next to the showers. And when you've got 35 men going to the showers and back, like I got changed in a puddle. And that wasn't because I was bullied or wasn't classed as good as everyone else, but I understood my position within the changing room. I wish we had a bit of that back. So I didn't take anything for granted. I mean, you've got Keith Wood, Jason Leonard, Will Greenwood, Dan Luger, Tony Diprose, just to mention a few of the stars that we had in our changing room. And there's me, who played for Hampshire under-17s. Get a grip of yourself. Understand what it is. And my first training sessions, I just wasn't built. I just was not built physically robust enough to play professional rugby. So I think the one bit of advice I would do is just keep your mouth shut and just open your ears, because there's loads of guys in the changing room that you can learn a lot from, who actually want to help you and make sure they hand over the baton and you can be everything that you can be.
Hmm. Do you have any strong memories of Ugo sitting politely in the corner, Keith, and knowing his place, or did he make a bit of an impact?
Well, no, he was very quiet, actually, and he was very quiet in the change room and in the team, like, because we weren't in too many change rooms together, actually, but we were in some of the team rooms together.
Yeah.
And because you're training, so we used to train early in the morning, and then the other guys would come in and train, and then you'd have a team meeting afterwards, and you'd talk about the game. I knew I wasn't going to be playing for 5 or 6 months, Ugo would go in and he would have been, he was very shy at the start, then he became really vocal and very comfortable with me, which was great. And then he'd go back quiet again once you're in the team meeting, because he didn't know the guys, he hadn't spent a huge amount of time with them. So he got to know the younger guys, he'd be comfortable with those. But, you know, these are intimidating rooms, you know. So, but I knew I wasn't going to be playing. You know, the chances of me playing again for the club were slow, so I would have still been fighting my corner. So he'd have been quiet in the room, I wouldn't have been quiet in the room, and because I always thought that was something that was important. And it was, for me, at the end of my career, knowing I wouldn't play, I was very happy to argue all the time, because you're not arguing for yourself, because you're arguing for the betterment of the team, and that's something that becomes very important. And it's funny, you mentioned that's what you'd recommend. That's what I would recommend for certain kids that are coming through. And I would recommend different things for others. There was a brilliant young guy who died when we were in the club, called Nick Duncan, played a few times for England, and picked up an infection when he was on holidays and died very quickly, an awful tragedy. And Nick had broken his neck when he was 17 or 18, had come back, had played again. He was a really small guy, really tiny scrum half, fit as you like, and had come back from a broken neck to go and play for England at 2021. But he used to terrorize me in the training sessions. It was unbelievable. Every time there was a ruck on, he'd try and lean in over the other way to slap my bald head. He was smacking me all the time. And he would terrorize me for the whole thing. And I just... Do you know what? You kind of want to throttle him half the time. But I love the fact that he had that sense of confidence, that he would understand that you could have fun, that you should have fun. And anyway, huge loss for us when he died. But there are different ways for kids to react to sport. I think you want kids to be themselves. Yeah. So if they are very shy, they're going to be shy. If they're outward, they want to be outward. They just need to know when you can flick that switch properly for them to get the most out of themselves.
Mm. Ugo, I listen to you now on the BBC Rugby podcast, and we see on BT Sport, and you're very much a natural broadcaster. But also I would say that you have a really strong philosophy on the game. So you will watch Six Nations games and you will come on the Monday or Tuesday and say, well, I thought this, 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 and I spotted that, and I didn't like this, and I did like that, and go through all the games and have a really strong opinion on how both teams went about their business. At what age as a player did you develop that kind of confidence in your own opinion and feel, I really understand this game, and back in the day, Keith Wood used to be arguing in the team room, now I'm the guy who's going to take charge. When did you become that type of player? Because I'm assuming based on your broadcasting, you must have.
Yeah, I loved analysis. I always wanted to know as to why things would work, how to break down defences, and how we can use or utilise the players that we have to be able to generate the most impact out of the team collectively. That was something which probably came just slightly later in my career, I'd say like mid-20s, because I think just as important it is to be a good athlete, to be a good rugby player, to be physically fit and all those things, you've got to be a student of the game. For me, when I look at rugby now and I look at the longevity of the very best players, they get the game, they understand it, they're able to pass knowledge, and it's not just them looking after what's happening in their lane, but being able to filter it out to the rest of the team, to upskill and get everyone better. Because there's nothing better when you're on the pitch and everyone knows their jobs. And even better than that is before you get on the pitch, you trust everyone has done the work, and therefore you can just go on and just crack on. So, yeah, that probably came in my early 20s. I used to like badger attack defensive coaches. What about this move? What about that? I've seen they do this sort of restarts, but just like Keith was saying, like, I was able to build my way into the team, be part of the first team, and be able to meaningfully contribute. I think once you become relatively established, then you can perhaps start to put your hand up in, that's how I feel anyway, put your hand up in the team room and start questioning why we started to do certain things. So analysis has always been a big part of what I do and something I really enjoy. I'm just really lucky to be able to do it in a slightly different guise. And actually broadcasting now is given me such a broader perspective on the game, because for 14 years, I looked at things through a Harlequin's lens. This is how we do it, and that was the only way. Now I'm able to look at Leinster and see the way they attack through their tight five, or watch the way they counterattack through certain individuals, or see Saracens, how they suffocate people through defences, or look at Clermont and their power game, and actually have a broader understanding and almost have this melting pot of what rugby looks like based on different clubs, messages from coaches and different environments and how that all comes together. So yeah, I might have the slight utopian view. And the one thing I forever feel as a pundit is a total hypocrite, because we become glory supporters and we comment on the perfect game. Oh, it was a 3-on-2. Why didn't he do this? I've butchered that a million times. But I guess it's our job to point it out. How's he missed that tackle? Why did he miss that clear out in the ruck? Do you mean all those different things? I don't become this pundit saying things because I was brilliant at all of them. It's just, I guess at home, people want to understand as to why things work and why things don't.
Something I think you were brilliant at was being a good teammate. So Keith mentioned this as well. He just said you were a great fella. And here's an interview from Paul Ackford in 2012 in The Telegraph. And he opens by saying, I sometimes make a couple of provisional calls before I interview someone, this someone being you, to get the lowdown, get a bit of background. Now, not to mates of the interviewee, but to people who work at the club or on the admin side or in the kit room, a considerable distance down the food chain from the star man. I did this with Ugo Monya, and boy, is he loved. Great guy, said one. Always hanging around the offices. Always asking how you are. Genuinely interested. Not the type to come in, train, and then disappear off home, which some players do. He's a top bloke. So that's quite nice. Sounds like you made an effort to conduct yourself in the right way.
I mean, they're lovely words, and they're painting me to be this like perfect professional and all-round good bloke. And I think sometimes I can be a good bloke. Sometimes I won't finish a sentence. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was lucky to play at one club 14 years, and I think why you stay at one club for a lengthy period of time is because you love everything about the club. I used to get frustrated. So, for example, every Christmas we had the big game. The 8,500 would run out pyrotechnics, you'd run out and there'd be 30,000 flags and everyone's waving all the rest of it. We'd finish the game. So we didn't always win them. So regardless of the result, the effort was put into putting that up. And I actually felt slightly frustrated because whether we played well or not, people had gone to different levels to be able to put that on for us and for our families to be able to enjoy this and celebrate the club. So I would make a note of going into the office the following Monday and just saying, like, thank you. Thank you for selling it out. Because as professional rugby players, you run out, brilliant environment, thank you very much, everyone loves you, you go home. But you forget the fact that people have been up since 5:30 and wanted to put flags out, that ticketing staff have been under pressure for the last 9 months to sell it out. Sponsors have paid through their nose to be able to put this on. So I just have a slightly deeper and more encapsulated love for Harlequins. But yeah, that's what it was. I was invested in not just the players, but the people that played there. But that, I mean, that's a nice article. I feel like I'm on an episode of This Is Your Life. And people only just say nice things about you. I'm sure if Paul actually dug a little bit deeper, there'd be a lot of people to dish a bit of dirt to me as well.
Keith, let's dish. You can dish all the dirt you want on him.
Yeah, no, I don't dirt on him, which is kind of disturbing. I do have one final nice thing to say about him. I got a phone call from Keith Earls on the 2009 Lions tour, and he said, "What's the story with the Ugo Monya?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, is he not the nicest guy you've ever met? I mean, I talk about a bromance. He loved the idea. You're from two totally different places. You got on like a house on fire on that tour. That's part of the story, which is pretty good. You only stayed at Quinn's. You never went anywhere else.
No.
And you loved it. And you went down with Quinn's, you went to the second division, then you won the second division, then you came back up, won the Premier Division. What was that like? Was that really, really turbulent at that time?
That was brutal, Woody. And I'll be honest and like just be transparent. So yeah, we got relegated in 05 and I was just on the cusp of making an England debut. So I got selected to go on England tour that summer and I just felt like my individual career was doing that. The club was doing that. And I was frustrated. I spoke to Mark Evans and said, I don't think static wins. We just can't. You know, you've got a limited shelf life. The average career length in the Premiership, 7 years. I don't think I can be here. I want to play in the Premiership because I want to play for England, and that's the sights that I've put out for myself. He argued with me. I met with Dean Richards, the incoming boss, and he just said, we're not going. Andre Voss isn't going. Got Andrew Merton's rocking up. Will Greenwood is staying. You'll stay. And that was it. So it took me a little while just to adjust because I was stepping into the unknown, and I guess I didn't want to play professional rugby to not ever play at the top level. But the year was brilliant, and it was actually the birthplace of so many of the current crop of talent which you see, your Chris Robshaws, your Joe Marlers, your Mike Browns, just to mention a few. So 05 was tough, like, was really tough. Because I think the first month you found yourself doing loads of analysis and opposition, but for everyone else, it's their World Cup final. So the guy that couldn't catch a high ball was just the most, he was Israel Folau in the air. He was like the most incredible athlete you've ever met. But then coming back was amazing. And then actually, you look at these things retrospectively, don't you? And you realise that was where we actually found our identity, found our culture, found our style of play, which we ended up winning the Premiership title in 2012. So, massive. Once again, another setback ended up turning out to be a huge positive.
I remember going to one of those second division matches in Bedford. Jeff Irvin, the owner of Bedford at the time, said, come on, Woody, come on up and have a little look. And watching Mertens playing at that level, I mean, apart from the fact he was the most amazing rugby player, yeah, and he had a brain of all brains. He saw everything like 10 phases in advance. But to watch him play at a lower level, you know, because he didn't really make a tackle and he didn't really get tackled, you know. But his ability to just pick apart and always make the right decision was quite an amazing thing. What was it like playing with him? I never got the chance, actually.
Actually, I'll tell you what. Meeting him for the first time was a huge disappointment. And it was because Andrew Mertens, who played for the All Blacks over 70 times, was like, I cannot wait. I'm going to score a million tries. Then you come in, you know what it's like, first day of pre-season, you do your fat testing. He took his top off and I was like, whose dad is this? Like where's this All Black Rooster side? Like, who is this? And he didn't have the best rig, but you speak to most guys that play Super Rugby, they spend more time catching and passing than they do in the gym. We're obsessed with it in England. So all these lads are absolutely ripped to pieces, massive chest, deadlift, 300 kgs, but finish a 2-1, we won't be able to do it. Mertz was total opposite. But playing with him was a joy because not only was the division he was playing in but of a different standard to what he was used to, but it just allowed us just the freedom. He just threw the ball around, to your point, Woody, could just orchestrate and manipulate defences, but then have the utter sense just to be able to tight spiral the ball 60 metres up the pitch. And above all else, what a wonderful human being. And hilarious guy.
Well, we have him on during the week, so I'm going to pick up on him, his dad's bod, just to see whether he considers you to be the nice guy or not, you know.
We'll have a few stories to share. We're actually on an old boys WhatsApp group, and he's very good value on it, very good.
So the total other end of the spectrum then of all these good aspects to Harlequins, how much of a regret is Bloodgate? How much does that linger in your memory? How much does that sully your time at this club that you love so much?
I mean, it's unavoidable, isn't it? It's a stain that will forever be there. It's a really frustrating time as well because things at the club are going really well. We're in a European Cup quarter final against Leinster. Yeah. The unfortunate thing is, and sorry to use the word, but that level of behaviour bled into our system, not just what Harlequins were doing right across the league. And I won't point fingers and name names and name clubs, but that was just a part of what we did. We were so complacent with it because it was a case of, yeah, we've got everything, yet boots, bag, yet blood capsules, yet got in the physio bag. That was just a part of what we did. And it was a shame. It wasn't a shame that we got caught because it actually cleaned up the league massively. There was one other case which totally went under the radar in a European semi-final later on that year where the same thing happened. And I remember ringing the player and saying, are you joking? I can't believe you've done this. But in terms of marring the history of Harlequins, I'd like to believe we've come on a huge way since that. You know, I guess throughout this conversation, I spoke about setbacks and how they've turned into positives, getting injured, training with Woody, going down into Championship, being the birthplace for all our young talent. And then in 09, Bloodgate, and being right across every single front page. And then 3 years later, winning the Premiership. So it was a devastating time. I actually didn't realise the impact that it had in the squad to probably the next year and some individuals, Tom Williams namely. But when you're losing good men, so Steph Brennan, the physio, just got the top job at England. Obviously, he had to move away from that, lost his physio licence. The doctor, Wendy Richards, I mean, for us to tell you, her story alone was just absolutely devastating. Staff in the office that are made redundant. I mean, the impact was so far wide-reaching that for us to not put our hands up and actually totally claim responsibility would have been pathetic of us. But yeah, there's a frustration. It's part of our history. I was ashamed at the time. Do I feel any shame now? No, I think you've got to move on, and those wounds have got to heal, which is out there in the public domain. And, and I guess in 10 years' time, you might ask some of the Saracens guys, how do they feel about what's happened in the last year? It's one of those things which everyone will forever associate with your club, but you just have to move on and evolve.
I didn't realise it was that routine a thing, that there was that level of complacency about it, that this was almost, you know, as you said, part of the kind of routine of match day to have the blood capsule ready. I didn't know it was that extreme.
Yeah, I mean, it was there on hand if we used it. I think we got found guilty quite clearly in that match against Leinster, and I think it was three other occasions. But it could have been more had we needed to use it, that was for sure. But I think that was a process which clubs had done in the Premiership for a number of years. And it's sad, really. The best thing to happen that day was that we lost the Leinster, because it would have been a total farce.
Yeah, and Keith, please come in, actually. Sorry, Keith. One other thing. I don't know, did you hear a podcast with Tom Williams and Will Greenwood maybe about a year, 18 months ago? The effect it's had even on his life is extraordinary. He was saying, you know, he would still think about it every day and feels like when people look at him, that's what they see. You know, dropping the kids to school. The human cost is very, very real.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like all these things are devastating. We do forget at times that it's just individuals that are involved in it and they do have to carry it for a long time afterwards. I didn't know it was so pervasive in the game at that stage either. That's the first time I've heard you say that, Hugo. But that just makes it for being very, very difficult. And just, I think, shows how the game changed then again afterwards, because it started bringing in more subs so that this wouldn't be a sort of situation. And it was kind of a way around a recognition that you needed to have players on the field and that rugby was becoming a harder game. But unconscionable, really, for the most part. And I do think it's one of those things that does cause a stain. But you do have to get on and move on after it. So this is 10 or 11 years later. Quins have had ups and downs ever since then. And I think it's one of those great cautionary tales that fits into the game.
The lines in 09, Keith mentioned, I mean, your timing was good. You made your England debut in March of 09, and then suddenly your British and Irish line starting the first test against South Africa. That's a hell of a trajectory to take. Was that a happy tour, a fun tour? It's always talked about as one which really kind of re-caught the Lions' spirit.
Unbelievable experience. I think the Lions is, I think for some rugby players, this unicorn. It's hard to set your goal on it because it's once every 4 years and try and get your timing right, be fit in the right place. And lots of great men have been able to miss out on it due to loads of different reasons. But yeah, I made my debut 6 months previous, I think, or something like that anyway. And so the timing was great. I knew I was playing good rugby, but once again, you have that kind of pinch yourself moment where you're called onto the Lions tour, and then you're surrounded by all these legends. And for me, that 09 Lions tour was the end of those legends of that era. Your O'Connells, your O'Garas, David Wallace, your Stephen Jones, and your Martin Williams. You know, they're the guys I watched and aspired to play at their level. Your Brian O'Driscolls, there's loads of them to mention. But as a tour, it was also the last tour where social media wasn't as big as intruder as what it is now. So we probably did things and behaved in ways and had fun in certain ways, which you just couldn't do today. You just couldn't. And but not only was it my favourite tour, because it was my only tour, but when you speak to guys that have done on multiple tours, and although it wasn't a successful tour, and they say that was their favourite tour, it's one of those, it's one of those moments in my life where genuinely, if rugby had finished for me then, I'd have been just so happy to be part of that exclusive club.
What was part of that being so much fun to do with Ian McGeachan?
Yeah, I think so. Also, Paulie had a massive say in that alongside like Warren Gatland. So the chemistry between the coaches and the senior leadership group and how that filtered through to us just allowed us. I mean, we had some big characters on the tour. You know, the likes of your Andy Power is probably just as famous for driving down the M4 in a golf cart as he's playing for Wales. You know, trying to manage characters like him when, you know, you're into the test series and they're not playing can be quite tricky, quite difficult. But also the part of the challenge of playing against the world champions in their backyard. And I tell you what, as a rugby education, playing your rugby in South Africa has got to be right up there, because it's just a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, they're showing a lot of those games again on the TV at the moment in lieu of not much else to show. Jeez, they stand up. They were ferocious.
Yeah, that second test in particular, I'd been dropped after the first test, and you know, you feel useless on the side of the pitch. Watching your guys not only lose the match in the manner in which we lost it, but also get injured. You know, we lost Gethin Jenkins to a fractured cheekbone, Adam Jones dislocated shoulder, Brian O'Driscoll head knock with Darnie Rousseau. He was didn't know what day of the week it was. Jamie Roberts fractured his wrist. And then Rog had his eye out here, Romo Gara had his eye out there. Walking into the changing room, I've never been in a changing quite as desperate, as devastating as that. You got Ian McGeachan, like everyone's grandfather, trying to address the team but not being able to hold it together and just cry his eyes out. You got Simon Shaws, man of the match, third Lions tour, first game, first test for the Lions, just got man of the match. He was in pieces. And yeah, it's so raw. What do you say? What can you do? How do you pick yourself up? That was probably one of the most ferocious. And everyone says things like this when you look back at historical games and then the game's moved on. But good Lord, I know we're 11 years on, but that was pretty tough even for now.
It must be interesting for you to get a glimpse of how the other countries do it. That was an Irish heavy tour. Irish rugby was in a great place then, and you had an Irish captain. What struck you about his captaincy or how the other Irish players maybe went about their business? Was there any great difference with an English dressing room?
I think the Irish were all very tight. That's not to say they didn't mix and mingle with everyone else, but one of my favourite rugby players of all time is Ron O'Gara. And I always liked him. I just thought he was just a wonderful competitor. I actually loved him just as much for what he did on the pitch as the things he said to the camera. If for Munster they underperformed and he wouldn't go so well, he'd get asked a simple question, where was the game won or lost? He said, well, if the front five turned up, we may have had a platform. And he was just desperately honest. And if he played badly, he would say it as well. And to then train with that kind of person and understand he has that level of accountability was just phenomenal. Dricko was just this magician who, although we had set piece plays and patterns, it was a case of just give him the ball and just let him do something. And it's quite rare to be in a team, especially at that level, where people just have carte blanche to do whatever they want. Paul O'Connell as a captain was just the perfect and archetypal type of character you need to go to South Africa, a warrior of a man. Just unbelievable skill set right across the board, and a great motivator of men. So I really got on with those senior players, and then you've got John Hayes, and then some of the younger ones, so like Rob Carney and Tommy Bowe and Keith Earls. Rob and Tommy, like, and Jamie Easley, they're good lads. They like to have fun. And when the tour is over, we certainly enjoyed ourselves, that's for sure.
I was reading your faith is very important to you. You would pray before matches, talk to your mum before matches. That strikes me as, good to have faith, I suppose, but also a nice thing to cloak yourself in playing high-level sport, a comfort blanket on top of things.
Yeah, well, I think faith can be exactly that. You know, I think I've been asked the question, if I had to do a week's worth of training or just say the one prayer before a match with my mum, what would I choose? I think I'd have far greater confidence by just speaking to my mum, saying a prayer on the phone before a match than training for the week. It was really important to me. If anything, you can almost relinquish a little bit of the anxiety, because I always just felt like, if God's got my back, like, what could go wrong? That wasn't to suggest that I would win every game and play well, because I'd have a few more caps than what I end up retiring on. But it was nice. There were certain occasions where it was slightly more difficult. I remember playing at the Stade de France, and would you know what the change rooms like? They're underneath the stadium, so trying to get signal there was quite tough. So I remember having to run out to the pitch and hiding behind one of the post protectors to get my mum on the phone. But it wasn't a case of this was, I don't know, because I think some people can get absolutely fixated on doing certain things, and the moment it can get removed from you, you can actually fall apart and become quite fragile. For me, it's something that, was it something I felt I deeply needed? Yeah, maybe to a certain extent, but something which gave me a lot of joy, a lot of comfort, and actually just allowed me just to go out and just play more in instinct, just enjoy it, knowing that I'll be okay.
Yeah.
Ugo, do you think you should have got more caps?
I think I could have got more caps. I think firstly, you've got to look at yourself. And I probably let myself down. I think I got to a period where I was very comfortable with rugby. I felt I was playing well. And I probably just took my foot off the accelerator for a little bit. And the moment you get comfortable, I'll tell you what, it's hard to get out of that spin. And I remember Sean Fitzpatrick, who I know you guys have had on the show, he said, always train like you're number two, not like number one. Like, you need to keep that hunger. And I think for a short period of time, like, I lost that hunger and I did get comfortable. And then what we have in England is the largest talent player pool in the world. And if you've lost that hunger and your performance dips a little bit, there'll be other people to take you over. There was a couple of games which I think really knocked my confidence. I got played out of position against Argentina in 2010. And looking back on it, it was a terrible decision, quite clearly, to blame me there. I had a shocker, and I reckon it was 6 months to recover from that. And that was off the back of a Lions tour. But my confidence was through the roof. I was flying high. I felt unbeatable, untouchable in a game. I thought, how can a defence actually stop me from scoring a try within the 80 minutes? I was so confident. And then I went off the back of that, good pre-season, into autumn internationals, played at fullback, had the worst game of my life. Forget professional career, talking under 13s, I've never played so poorly. And that took a little while for me to recover. So I think most massively take responsibility on myself and how I could have actually just worked a bit harder, stayed a bit more focused, because that's exactly what you need. But then there are other contributing factors. But I definitely had the ability to get a lot more caps. It's probably one of the frustrations which still sits with me even now that I'm retired.
It's amazing. It's still one of the parts of the game I think we haven't quite got on top of, which is confidence, dealing with confidence, dealing with the dip in confidence when it happens, whether you externalize it or internalize it.
Yeah.
But to not get into that spiral where it just drifts away from you. And it's just one of those elements. I remember looking for, near the end of my career, trying to find a good sports psychologist to work with the Irish rugby team, because we just felt that was something that was needed. But even still, when you talk to players, the last 2 or 3 years, and they say, yeah, I was playing very well, but I kind of lost my way a little bit, lost my confidence, it's taken a long time for it to come back. You know, it's that level of vulnerability that sits within sportsmen. We kind of overlook that very easily. We forget the human aspect of it as well. But it is something that's very, very key.
Totally agree. And it's Mental Health Awareness Week this week in England. I'm not sure whether that's shared right across Europe, I'm not quite sure, but actually been able to kind of monitor and keep a healthy mind is so important, because every sportsman is slightly vulnerable, for as bulletproof as they look on the pitch. And like you said, been able to get out of that funk, get out of that spiral, because the game's so cyclical. Forever, as good or bad you played on a Saturday. You've got to repeat it again Saturday. And when you're into week 42 of the season and you've not had a break and you're trying to find your confidence, it is quite tough. And then other thoughts may creep into your mind. You could get dropped. You could have contract, which is out at the end of the season. So trying to alleviate some of those exterior things, you can actually just fully focus on the game. It's the one part of our professional sport which I still believe is slightly amateur. There's not enough time or investment into actually dealing with professional sportsmen's minds.
Hugo, just a last one from me then before the clock really comes into play here. How have you dealt with retirement? It's obviously not easy.
I've been quite fortunate, I believe, just because I was able to call time on my own. You know, I think some players have the rug pulled from underneath them, then have a contract renewed. You know, we're in this COVID crisis at the moment, and there'll be a lot of players that would have played their last game way back in March and wouldn't have anticipated that happening. So I was lucky to be able to say, I want to retire at the end of the season, have the big swan song, and then get out. And although I've moved on, I haven't moved that far away. I didn't realise it at the time, but people spoke to my wife and said, keep an eye out for him in the next couple of months, because, you know, sportsmen and women, they struggle when they retire because you lose a sense of identity, a sense of purpose. And I booked ourselves, we got engaged, I booked ourselves a 3-week holiday. And the first week I was just loving life. I was waking up, breakfast, I was in Thailand on the beach, having breakfast on the beach, I was having a beer at 11 o'clock, and 3 days in a row I had a beer. The miss went, is everything okay? I said, yeah, fine. She went, it's just people just said, no, I should keep an eye out for you. I was like, are you kidding me? It's 35 degrees, I'm having beers on the beach. I think the lads are doing hills this morning. Life is good. But, so I'm one of the lucky ones. I moved on, but not that far away. Still being a part of rugby has been a massive tonic and has really actually helped me in terms of, I don't know, a sense of identity and a purpose and all those kind of things. But I do firmly believe that at some stage in your life, every sportsman or woman that exits whatever game it is will suffer mentally, physically or financially. I've had lots of friends of mine that have suffered all three. No money, hip operations, and actually then that then spirals and all of a sudden you fall into depression because you don't know what you're going to do next. So the way in which players transition, that's what's so important, just to look for something to do whilst you're still have a profile, whilst you're still playing the game, and think about what you're going to do next, whether it's education, business or whatever it is. And I Woody, but during your playing days, you were huge for that in terms of keeping yourself occupied.
Yeah, I loved it. I started in the amateur times, so I worked and then became a professional, but I worked all the way through because I liked it. And it also kept my mind off the game at the weekend. I have a guy I do some work with now. He's an Austrian guy, and his view is that, you know, pretty much youth finishes around 30. So everything you've done up to there is building you up for the rest of your life. So you don't have to think at the end of a rugby career that that's the end of your life. You can actually say that everything I've done gets me to this point. I have a couple of years that I can, you know, sort out my stuff, get it together, and then see how we plan going forward. And it is, I mean, it can be difficult because you've thrown all your eggs in that basket. So I would advise, as you have there, internships, college, extra education, getting a master's if you've already got a primary degree, seeing what it's like to work in a solicitor's office, an accountant's office, an agency, whatever it is, you have to open your mind up to the other things that happen. And you can do that and still be laser focused on your sport. And it is trying to get that level of balance. I don't even know if I got that balance right, but especially at the end of my career, when I was injured, I never got despondent. Because I was injured, I wasn't going to play on Saturday, I was going to work on Monday. And I worked on the Monday, even though I was still employed by Quinns and still could be there or thereabouts. I still said, oh yeah, now is the time to do something here. So, you know, I think it's a slightly different mindset. I think there was a period of the time, especially around your time, when a lot of those guys struggled. Now I think it's gone back again to being more positive, because I think a huge amount of the players that are coming through the system are studying, are looking to try and see what they're going to do post-rugby. And it isn't an end in itself. But like, I'm 48 years of age. I often slag it. I said I still have a couple of careers ahead of me. But it's trying to get your mind to that idea that when you finish something, that something else will start and can start. But you then have to remember that you have to work really hard at it. You know, nothing that you've done in rugby automatically gives you your next job. You have to work bloody hard at it again.
I totally agree with that mindset. I think there's a slight arrogance or a belief, because I achieved X, Y, and Z and I did whatever, that you'll just be fine and you'll just walk into whatever job. But if you had that mindset as a rugby player, you would never have achieved those things. You start in the academy, you work really hard, you get a club contract, you work even harder, and then you get recognised at international level. So if that was your process and your ideology whilst you played rugby, why do you think you're just going to go top of the tree in the working world? It doesn't work like that. It's never worked like that. Life doesn't work like that. And if you just follow exactly what Woody's done, maybe you one day you'll be just as rich as he will be, because he is bloody loaded, guys. Absolutely.
Rubbish. Rubbish.
On that note, Ugo Manya, you've been great with your time. Thanks so much for coming on and chatting about your career. Harlequins player, English international, British and Irish line. Great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Good to see you.
Keith Wood is still with us. Keith, before you go, the James Cronin situation has probably reached some kind of finality. Una May has been speaking. She spoke to the Irish Times last night of Sport Ireland. Where we were, where we had been, was that the EPCR had given James Cronin a one-month ban. I think people are familiar with the case at this stage. And Sport Ireland and or WADA could appeal. Neither have decided to do so. So Una May, speaking in the last 24 hours on behalf of Sport Ireland, said of the one-month ban, "It's extremely frustrating, but not unusual. It's quite common for us in cases where there is a small sanction that we would feel this level of frustration. A person can be tested in the latter part of a season and their situation is cleared before the next season starts. Or in this case, there is no season." So they said they were frustrated with the length of the ban. However, she went on to say, "We consider 1 month to be lenient. Now, we could put in a huge battle to increase it to 3 months and could be unsuccessful. For the sake of 2 months, it doesn't appear appropriate to go into that level of work and detail because there is a comprehensive file attached to this case." She said it could also take 6 months to a year before the case is heard. They're not hearing cases at the moment. Sometimes you have to be sensible about how we approach these things. "We are not comfortable. We're not comfortable with the 1 month. But the rigor in which the case was followed through initially did give us some comfort." And she pointed out that even though he didn't appear before the EPCR, the player's story wasn't just accepted right at the beginning, she said. "And we established the EPCR had liaised with WADA." And she said as well that the evidence supplied was very comprehensive. So that is probably the end point from an administrative and official point of view to this case. What have you made of the whole episode?
Yeah, I think, I think some parts of it have been excellent. And actually, Una May's conversation that she had yesterday and her highlighting all her frustrations with it have been fantastic. It's also shown up the EPCR's procedure as being right and proper, and they stood behind it. I do think they were involved in part of it earlier on, as were WADA. So I think that they were intimately involved all along. The frustration I absolutely get, because whether a month is lenient or not, and it's up for them to decide whether it is or not, the idea that it can happen in an off season I think is wrong, or it can happen in COVID I think is wrong. So I think that if there is now there's a very small level of blame apportioned to James Cronin, and he gets a proper rap on the knuckles, which he should do. But I think everybody would be a little bit more comfortable if that was a four-week suspension and there were four matches that he was going to miss. And so maybe that's something that would be looked at in the future. But I can understand those frustrations for us, because I do think we need to make certain that there is a deterrent, even from just a lack of attention to detail or whatever this would be described as.
Yeah. I mean, I take the point, and whether it's 3 months or 1 month, I think the real deterrent is that your name is publicly, you're talked about. There is a stigma. There is an asterisk after your name. I think ultimately 1 month, 3 months, I hadn't realized that Sport Ireland feel or felt that maybe 3 months is about as much as they could have hoped for in an extreme case of this nature, having looked at the evidence. personally, I don't think in it, you know, separate to the specifics of James Cronin, I don't think a player in a similar position would look at 1 month or 3 months and that would come into their minds. I think the real deterrent is publicly what happens to your name. So in some respects...
Yeah, in some respects, maybe not. And also, we talked about this in some of the previous conversation that we had with Hugo, was that you do have to think about the human element with this, and this is a mistake, and it's a mistake he has to deal with, and so that's very tough. So I kind of agree and disagree. Yeah. I just think when you have a ban. Even if it's a small ban, I think it should have some impact on you playing or not playing. And
yeah.
So I think that's where the frustration comes in. And actually, Una May did say that she sees people that get small bans at the end of the season and then they're ready for the start of the following season. That isn't much of a deterrent. It is a deterrent in the world of public opinion, of course it is, and in your own personal views and how you're dealing with it. But even if you look at someone like Joe Marler at the present moment in time, who gets a ban for dirty play and
for what exactly?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what it was for actually.
A lack of sportsmanship / dirty play /
I remember that.
I mean, I don't know how you term it, but yes, anyway.
Yeah, and but he is not going to miss any rugby from it, and that's just. Because of this particular situation, but whether that they then become the changes to how the laws are used to govern the sport.
Yeah. Last point on it. She did say, and this was a question, and we've had Anthony Davies on the show. Anthony Davies was presented with an agreed set of facts agreed between Munster lawyers and the law firm representing the EPCR. They're a London-based firm. And Davies made his 1 month decision based on those agreed set of facts. Now, it is notable that Una May said to the Irish Times that we are not comfortable with the 1 month, but she is happy with the rigour in which the case was followed through initially. She said that did give us some comfort. So they've looked at all the documentation and she says they're happy with the rigour with which the investigation happened. So that is a point worth making. The last point I wanted to put to you was Munster's handling of this situation. So there was the press release, whenever this news all broke, press releases from the EPCR, from Munster, from the RFU on the Monday. I would put it to you, now I don't know how the general public feel about this, so maybe this is a media perspective, and if it is, I make no apologies. But something like this is so serious. Rugby is the second most tested sport in this country. Sport Ireland have said there is a reason for that. There is a PR issue for the sport. And, you know, on top of the nuts and bolts of making sure things are kosher across the sport, there is also a perception issue. It strikes me as wrong, for want of a more specific word, that the likes of James Cronin hasn't spoken, that somebody from Munster hasn't spoken, that the doctor Jamie Kearns hasn't spoken. All of the above are one of the above to come out and acknowledge this is a big deal. We get this is a big deal. Here is our version of events. Everybody in this press conference via Zoom, ask us questions. We are transparent here to the end. I don't expect them to draft in the redacted name person and the pharmacy mightn't want to be along for the ride. But I think to just release the press releases and almost in effect say, right, bunker down and we'll see where things go. That isn't the best approach, I would put it to you.
Yeah, well, in terms of perception, I think that is fair. In terms of the reality, I think it's far more complicated than that because you don't know whether there's any legal information that's been held back, if there's any cases happening, if they're not allowed to talk for a whole variety of different reasons. And then you're just going to have to deal with that that perception and lack of information. Yeah. What you do actually hope is that whenever that all gets done and resolved, if there are legal views that are being taken with it.
Well, sorry to interrupt. It was reported, and I have a second source in this, that Cronin is certainly thinking of suing the pharmacy for legal costs. So well, then things like that you're talking about.
Well, then I would expect that he wouldn't be talking until after that fact. Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, we end up having that grey area that's uncomfortable for everybody to look at.
Okay. Well, we'll most certainly welcome them on down the line when they're
absolutely.
Ready.
Absolutely.
open to talk IRFU as well. Thanks so much for getting Ugamanya. Much appreciated, and we'll talk to you again.
Brilliant. Cheers, Joe.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in at home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in at home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.